welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Let's kick off the new year with a show dedicated to the men and women whose glorious music provided the soundtrack to our lives. Rock, jazz, soul, and classical, today's Book Report is for literary music lovers who've wondered about the true creative process, from the highs to the rock bottoms. I've researched some great new biographies out now. Our executive producer had the privilege of speaking with the legendary Glyn Johns, sound engineer and record producer for iconic bands like The Stones, Led Zeppelin, The Eagles, and The Beatles. You'll find his observations absolutely fascinating. So, let's learn more about the artists who've transcended genres and touched hearts across generations as we turn to page one of the Book Report. We'll begin with a look at the Piano Man. In Billy Joel, acclaimed musical journalist Fred Schreurs draws on more than 100 hours of exclusive interviews with Joel, plus in-depth talks with family, friends, and colleagues in this unprecedented look at the life, career, and legacy of the kid from Long Island. The book chronicles Joel's rise to the top of the charts, from his working-class origins in Levittown and early days spent in boxing rings and sweaty clubs, to his monumental success in the 70s and 80s. He also explores Joel's creative transformation in the 90s and beyond. Along the way, readers get the behind-the-scenes stories, including Joel's high-profile marriages and legal battles, events that defined his path to stardom and inspired his signature songs. Throughout, he captures the spirit of a restless artist determined to break through by sharing, in his deeply personal lyrics, the dreams and heartbreaks of suburban American life. Kirk Thornton narrates.
Rosalind, Roz as she was known for short, Nyman, arrived as the third of three daughters born to Philip and Rebecca in 1922 in the Coney Island neighborhood in Brooklyn, where the family had migrated after leaving England in 1914 at the outbreak of the First World War. Her father didn't want to get conscripted into the English army, relates Billy, which was a pretty smart thing to avoid. Roz and her parents, along with her elder sisters Muriel, born 1918, and Bertha, 1920, settled in the Flatbush district of Brooklyn on Ditmas Avenue. Billy would visit there and remember their home as a pile of dingy bricks, dark and small, a turn-of-the-century row house in a Jewish neighborhood with kosher butchers all around. His mother's parents would live there the rest of their lives. Philip Nyman had an anti-authoritarian streak that ran deep. As a young man, he fought with the Republicans in Spain against Franco and would be under suspicion in America for his leftist leanings. But he also had a kind of elegance in his bearing, Billy recalls. He didn't have a lot of money. As far as I could tell, the family never did. But he would sneak us into the Brooklyn Academy of Music by slipping the usher a pack of Luckies to see recitals and other classical music performances. The newlyweds, who had been united by Gilbert and Sullivan, had families more appropriate to Shakespeare's famous lovers, two households, both alike in dignity, with very little use for each other. Despite my parents' love for each other, says Billy, their two families weren't compatible at all. Carl was a German Jew, rightly or wrongly self-styled as the aristocrat of the tribe, and my mother's people were English and Russian Jews, whom the Germans would have viewed as the lower Untermenschen class. The courtship faced a still greater obstacle when Howard Joel was drafted into the U.S. Army in July 1943. He wasn't yet 21, but his ability to speak fluent German earned him a quick ticket to the European theater. Howard Joel was part of the Fifth Army, originally in the legendary Savage Italian campaign with General Mark Clark. From September 1943 through the war's end, the region's battles would result in 300,000 Allied casualties, about a fifth of that number deaths, mostly from the army's slog up the boot of Italy through the mountains.
We've just heard Billy Joel by Fred Schreurs. Era Aerosmith's Joe Perry opens up for the first time about the wild inside story of his life in the legendary band he co-founded in 1970. In Rocks, My Life in and Out of Aerosmith, Perry exposes his unrepentant, unbridled life as the lead guitarist of Aerosmith. He delves into his volatile, profound, and enduring relationship with singer Steve Tyler and reveals the real people behind the larger-than-life rock gods on stage. Aerosmith's story is ultimately one of endurance. It began nearly half a century ago with young Perry, who quit school because he didn't want to cut his hair. He meets Tyler in a restaurant in New Hampshire, sways him from pop music to rock and roll. It doesn't take long for the toxic twins to skyrocket into a world of fame and utter excess. Perry, who narrates, takes a personal look into the human stories behind Aerosmith. The people who enabled them, the ones who controlled them, and the ones who changed them. In his own words, Rocks is the loner story, the band story, the recovery story, the cult story, the love story, the success story, the failure story, the rebirth story, the redestruction story, and the post-destructive rebirth story.
The lure of the woods is its primitive beauty. My dream life in the woods has me lost in a grove of ancient trees. If I keep walking long enough, I'll find my way out. But I'm not sure I want out. Being lost in the wilds has a certain comfort. There is no destination, no home. I don't know what's around the bend. A wolf, a wildcat, a venomous snake. I like not knowing. I like the dense undergrowth, the sharp smells of the forest. The songs of the birds, the ever-changing weather, the dark clouds, the quickening of my heartbeat as I suddenly realize that I and I alone am responsible for my survival. For the rest of my life, I'll stare into the unknown. In the water and the woods, I face danger and discovery. In my real life, as a boy born September 10, 1950, and raised in the small, quiet town of Hopedale, Massachusetts, I keep going back to the water in the woods. That's where I seek anonymity. It's where I can disappear into wordless, endless wonder. I'm not saying that I'm able completely to disappear from emotional ups and downs that characterize every childhood. I'm saying that I want to. My earliest memories all involve being drawn deep into nature, where I welcome, rather than fear, getting lost. I welcome the mysteries that lurk at the bottom of the sea and live inside the dark forest of night. My parents were good and honorable people. They cared for their two children, my younger sister Anne and myself, with love and concern. My mother Mary was a graduate of Boston University with a master's degree. She taught physical education in the public schools. Her mind was both curious and brilliant. She was always reading about everything from the Earth's chakras to the metaphysics of quantum theory to John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie. She wore her hair short and exuded great confidence. As a strong and proud working mom of the 1950s, she was a woman of the future, a liberated woman decades before the movement began. My father, Tony, was equally upstanding. He had gone to Kent State and graduated from Boston's Northeastern University with a major in accounting. He had grown up in Lowell, Massachusetts, where his dad, a Portuguese immigrant from the island of Madeira off the coast of Morocco, worked in the factories and later owned a funky little grocery store. My dad was born in Lowell. When he was two, the family moved back to Madeira, where my dad spent his childhood before moving back to the States. After serving in the U.S. Army Air Force till the end of World War II, Dad graduated from college and began working as an accountant, taking his first steps towards self-reinvention. The family name, Pereira, was shortened to Perry by his father, and rather than stay in Lowell, Dad moved to Hopedale, some 30 miles outside of Boston, where the American dream had been set out in the form of suburban perfection. Hopedale was where my father entered the upper middle class. Founded in 1842, Hopedale was one of the country's first utopian communities. It began as a picture-perfect Norman Rockwell village of industrious dreams. In the 1850s, the Draper Corporation, manufacturer of power looms for the textile industry, took over the town. In the 1950s, my dad went to work for Draper as a cost accountant. He and Mom bought a duplex in Bancroft Park and rented out the other side. Mom's parents, the Ursulos, hailed from Naples, Italy, and would have loved to see their daughter enter a nunnery. She rejected most of their old-world notions about womanhood, but she accepted their Catholicism, at least to the point of attending Sunday Mass and making sure that her husband and children did the same.
We've just heard Rocks, My Life in and Out of Aerosmith by Joe Perry and David Ritz. For more than 50 years, Glyn Johns has been revered as one of rock and roll's greatest sound engineers and record producers. He was the man in the control booth, driving the amazing sound of hundreds of albums, from the greatest Rolling Stones records to the Beatles' Abbey Road and Let It Be, to the first albums from Led Zeppelin and the Eagles. In his new book, Sound Man, he describes what it was like to be present when the iconic music of a generation was being made and the quirky people behind the sound. His account is really valuable because Glyn Johns never touched a drug in his life, so his memories are funny and clear. Our executive producer, Derek Hewitt, is a big fan, so let's listen as he chats to Glyn Johns.
Hello, Glyn, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
My pleasure.
The title of your book, Sound Man, is especially apt and amusing because not only were you the man managing the sound for the great groups of the last 50 years, you were often the only sober one in the studio because you never took drugs of any kind. You must have come under pressure to do so. So how did you resist?
It was very simple. I had absolutely no desire whatsoever. You can't do what I do if you're me and if you're under the influence of anything, coffee would be about it. One, two, I objected to the principle at the beginning. In order to be accepted by somebody, you had to do whatever they were doing. That principle offended me enormously. So on two counts, it was very simple to do.
Well, good. You describe the job of producer as to have an opinion and the ego to express it more convincingly than anyone else. Did the fact that you were sober make it easier to get your point across?
Well, it depends on how stoned the people I was talking to were, I suppose. I could certainly string a sentence together, but,
right.
But I don't know how easy it was for them to understand.
Right. It's well known that you ran a very tight ship in the recording studio, and thank goodness you did. We probably wouldn't have a lot of the great music if you hadn't. But in the book, you mention several times how you may have been blinkered and hard-headed at times and had to be pushed by people like David Geffen to pay attention to various artists. But the book is really filled with generous acknowledgement of the contributions of others and the admission that you came around to recognize the greatness of people. And you generously acknowledge that you were wrong about, for example, Eric Clapton. What made you mellow out and become such a generous and giving guy?
Maybe I started taking drugs. No, that actually is not true. No, I have no idea. You know what? I suppose you, as you get older, you mellow, don't you? Hopefully. And equally, I don't work anything like the same extent that I used to. So I have a little more free time, and therefore I'm not as quite as stressed out as I used to be, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, no, you mentioned working with your son is such a great blessing, and maybe that's one of the things that gets you calmer. Anyway. You also mentioned that you started working with the Stones again after engineering and producing some of the earlier albums, just as Mick Taylor was leaving, and you did a lot of sessions in Munich. So this was really fascinating, because you talk about a version of Fool to Cry that, as you say, eats the later version that they actually released. There are other places in the book where you mention, you know, better versions of songs than the ones that actually made it onto the air, and you hint that you may have tapes. This raises a really tantalizing prospect of hearing familiar music afresh. Do you think there's a chance that the groups or labels involved will ever allow you to release the Glyn Johns Mixes of the Masters album?
No, I don't think that for a second. And in fact, listen, I'm biased in my opinion that they might be better than what was eventually released. I'm sure others wouldn't necessarily agree. And certainly in the case of the artist, and it's the artist's performance and life and career that these recordings supposedly represent. So I would honour their wishes above anybody else's anyway. But it's also something I would never seek to do. It's not important. Nothing's that important. The fact of the matter is that all that material's been released in perhaps a later mix or a different format, and people have learned to enjoy it that way, and that's fine. I don't think it's that important, to be honest.
Well, as a Stones fan, I'd love to hear that mix, but...
Well, I'm sure you would. I'll tell you what, I'll send you a CD.
We're speaking with Glyn Johns on The Book Report.
You really seem to enjoy bringing together British and American musicians, and you paint wonderful and very kind pictures of the incredible talents you worked with. After reading the book, you know, I can't wait to listen again to, for example, Emmylou Harris or Georgie Fame or the White Mansions and Legend of Jesse James albums, which are sort of lesser-known folks, at least in the U.S., but who sound incredibly worth re-listening to. So what do you think makes some great music just not get recognized at the time that it's released?
Well, there are very often commercial reasons for it. And you mentioned White Mansions and Jesse James. Both of those records had a collaboration of several artists. They weren't all on the label that eventually released the record, A&M. And so there are contractual reasons why you can't have a single release or whatever, because the other label won't let you do it. But equally, as a result of that, as we all know, the way of promoting any album is by releasing singles, and they get airplay, and that gets everyone to hear the record. So with both of those albums in particular, there wasn't really what would be termed as a commercially successful single on either of them, which actually doesn't mean anything as far as the quality of the music is concerned. We all know that there's some great music that would never see the light of day on a single. But they're perfect examples of why those records didn't get the attention that they deserve.
Right.
Today. And there's another record I made many years ago with Pete Townsend and Ronnie Lane called Rough Mix, which I talk about in the book also, and I think it's one of the best records I ever made. And it got sat on, I think, by MCA. They had their own reasons for it, because I think The Who were about to release an album shortly thereafter, and they didn't want it to conflict.
You've worked with all of the very best. If you had to put together a fantasy supergroup of people who've never played together, who would be in your lineup, do you think?
I do love mixing musicians together who, particularly, as you just mentioned, from the United States and England, or United Kingdom, that there's a difference in the way Americans feel in a rhythm section, feel the groove of the song. To Americans, and very often the combination of the two can be very interesting. But the most important thing is to put people in a room with each other who would get a buzz off playing with them. And I've managed to do that. Like, for example, the Ryan Adams record, Nora Jones and Ben Montench, both extraordinary keyboard players, quite different from each other, but we used them on the record, and the end result is quite remarkable, actually, more in what they didn't play than what they did. They left so much space for each other out of respect. But that record is a great example of, they're all astonishing musicians, as is Ryan, and it's a great example of what we're just talking about. Everyone in that room had a massive respect for each other, and everybody in particular wanted to work with Ryan and experience what it would be like to work with them, and it really paid off.
Wow, what a great experience to be there. Readers, Glyn Johns' book, Sound Man, is a must-read for anyone trying to understand the last 50 years of amazing music. Thanks for joining us today, Glyn.
Well, thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
Aretha Franklin began life as the golden daughter of a progressive and promiscuous Baptist preacher. Raised without her mother, Aretha was a gospel prodigy who gave birth to two sons in her teens and left them and her native Detroit for New York, where she struggled to find her true voice. It was not until 1967 when a white Jewish producer insisted she return to her gospel soul roots that fame and fortune finally came. As we see in Respect, the life of Aretha Franklin by acclaimed music writer David Ritz, Aretha has evolved ever since amidst personal tragedy and career reinventions. Brad Raymond performs the book.
Smokey Robinson, who had grown up in Detroit around the corner from the Franklins and was Cecil's closest friend, made many of those introductions. Aretha's siblings became my allies in convincing her to take me on as a collaborator. Over the years, they provided me with invaluable and detailed information about their sister. Every time I went to Detroit, which was often, I sent Aretha a postcard expressing my hope that we could meet. Then, in 1994, it happened. On a Wednesday night at approximately 8 o'clock, the phone rang in my room in the Athenaeum Hotel. "Mr. Ritz," she said, "this is Aretha Franklin." A lifetime stutterer, I couldn't get out the first word. For a second, I panicked. What if my two-decade pursuit resulted in my inability to utter a single sentence? What if the shock of her call rendered me mute? What if, right then and there, I blew the whole thing? Perseverance overwhelmed fright, and with considerable difficulty, I managed to say how happy I was that she called. "I'm interviewing collaborators for my autobiography," she said, "and I wanted to speak with you." "Thank you, Miss Franklin." I wanted to call her Aretha, but the formality of her tone, she would call me Mr. Ritz for several more weeks, let me know that would be unwise. "I want to hear how you would go about working with me," she said. "I'll be glad to come see you whenever it's convenient," I said. "I'm not doing personal interviews, just phone calls." "So this is it?" My question triggered her first laugh. "Yes, Mr. Ritz, this is it. Tell me your approach." I explained in the most impassioned terms possible my view of this project, that it was her book I was interested in, not mine, that I was convinced hers was one of the great untold stories in modern American culture, that no one loved her music more than I, that no one listened to her records more obsessively or followed her career as studiously as I did, that no one would work harder to render her authentic voice authentically, that it was my lifetime dream to tell her story and tell it right. She ended the call without saying when a decision would be made. I couldn't sleep that night. Until the second call came a week later, I was a mess. When I learned that Miss Franklin had selected me, it was one of the happiest moments of my life. The first thing I did was pull out her glorious gospel album, Amazing Grace, and listen to it from start to finish. I called my friend Billy Preston, whom I had met through Ray Charles decades earlier, to tell him the good news. Billy and Aretha shared a common mentor, Reverend James Cleveland, the gospel great and one of my most reliable sources of information regarding Aretha. Billy had traveled the same sacred to secular path as Aretha. They'd known each other since they were kids. They'd been in the same studios and on the same stages together dozens of times. For years, Billy had given me insights into Aretha's world. He congratulated me and added a warning. "Keep your hopes high and your expectations low." "Why do you say that, Billy?" "Because I know her, and girlfriend ain't giving it up, ever." I didn't want to believe him. I didn't want to believe other friends and associates of Aretha who told me that I'd never break through her armor and get the real story. I didn't want to believe Irma Franklin, who said, "I love my sister dearly, and my prayers are with you." Nothing would make me happier than to see her purge all that pain she's been through. But honestly, I don't see her doing that. She's built a wall around herself that no one's been able to climb over. Fueled by an inexhaustible enthusiasm, I saw myself scaling that wall, even if others said that was impossible. Nearly all Aretha's closest associates echoed Billy Preston and Irma. They said that Aretha had been increasingly difficult to work with, impatient, controlling, and quick to anger. I didn't care. I'd change all that. I'd be so patient, so uncontrolling, so sweet and mellow that she'd have to come round. After all, at that point in my career, I knew how to handle stars. I was used to difficult personalities. For all his brilliance, Ray Charles could be cantankerous.
We've just heard Respect by David Rintz. Leonard Bernstein was a charismatic and versatile musician, a brilliant conductor who attained international superstar status, a gifted composer of Broadway musicals, symphonies, choral works, film scores, and so much more. Bernstein was also an enthusiastic letter writer, and in the Leonard Bernstein letters, Nigel Simone presents them in this first collection of his wide-ranging correspondence. The letters were selected for insights they offered into the passion of the man, musical and personal. Bernstein's letters reveal those close to him, his collaborators, and his mentors. His galaxy of correspondents included Aaron Copland, Stephen Sondheim, Jerome Robbins, Thornton Wilder, Boris Pasternak, Betty Davis, Jackie Onassis, and family members, including his wife Felicia and his sister Shirley. The majority of these letters have never been published before. They've been chosen to demonstrate the breadth of Bernstein's musical interests, his constant struggle to find the time to compose, his turbulent and complex sexuality, his political activism, and his endless capacity for hard work. George Guidall performs the book.
Illuminating a Musical Life. Anyone interested in Bernstein has the great advantage of Humphrey Burton's superbly researched and beautifully written biography. 20 years after its first publication, it remains definitive as well as enthralling, and subsequent writers on Bernstein owe Humphrey Burton a great debt of gratitude. The present book would have been unthinkable without his work, but it sets out to do something different. While Burton quotes from a good deal of correspondence, his main purpose is to tell a life story. In the Leonard Bernstein letters, I have aimed to allow the letters mostly to speak for themselves rather than to be woven into a linear biographical narrative. In addition, a number of letters have emerged or become available since Burton's book was published in 1994. One of the delights of the Bernstein collection is its astonishing breadth. There's extensive correspondence not only with those working in music, but also with writers, politicians, film stars, artists, journalists, and long-standing friends who offered Bernstein support at times when he needed it. I have tried to reflect something of the range of these friendships. Even so, it is as a gigantic musical personality that Bernstein is remembered, and this has been my primary criterion for choosing the letters to include in what is the first published volume devoted to Bernstein's correspondence. In terms of other composers, Bernstein was in very close contact with Aaron Copland from the end of the 1930s onwards, and he also had an extensive correspondence with David Diamond stretching over 5 decades, a group of letters sometimes marked by tetchiness on Bernstein's part and by a tendency to oversensitivity on Diamond's. Such is the volume of the correspondence that I have had to omit letters from other close musical friends such as Paul Bowles and Irving Fine. These deserve to see the light of day in a future publication. In addition to correspondence with composers and performers, I have also aimed to include letters that chart the genesis of Bernstein's compositions. 2 of his first big successes were collaborations with Jerome Robbins, a ballet, Fancy Free, and a musical, On the Town. In the case of Fancy Free, much of it was conceived and composed while Robbins and Bernstein were working away from home. As a result, there was detailed discussion by letter. It's frustrating that Robbins' letters to Bernstein about this ballet seem not to have survived. Bernstein was constantly moving house at the time, and it was just before the arrival on the scene of his assistant Helen Coates who ensured that everything thereafter was carefully saved. However, Bernstein's letters to Robbins constitute a fascinating chronicle of the work's composition. On the Town is a very different case, a collaboration where those concerned were working in the same place at the same time. As a result, there is no substantial correspondence about it with any of the collaborators, Bernstein, Robbins, Betty Comden, and Adolph Green. Indeed, in 1945, just after the show had opened on Broadway, Comden mentioned in a letter to Bernstein that it was the first time she had written him since 1941. West Side Story presents a more complex case, partly because it took so long to get started. A fascinating letter from Arthur Lawrence, undated but probably written in April 1949, raises some detailed points responding to what had evidently been a difficult phone conversation with Bernstein. A follow-up letter from Lawrence reveals that Bernstein considered pulling out of the project altogether. In 1955, the collaboration was revived with greater determination on all sides to see it through. Again, there are some revealing letters, especially one from Robbins, in which he responds in detail to Lawrence and Bernstein about a draft scenario. Stephen Sondheim joined the creative team just after this, but there is no correspondence with him about the show until the opening night on Broadway, 26 September 1957. Then, a few weeks later, a marvelous description of the sessions for the original cast recording and the trials and tribulations of the show early in its run.
That was the Leonard Bernstein Letters, compiled by Nigel Simone. In Herbie Hancock, Possibilities, the legendary jazz musician and composer reflects on a career that spanned 7 decades. Hancock has had an enormous influence on both acoustic and electric jazz, R&B, and hip-hop. With his ongoing exploration of different musical genres, he's won 14 Grammys. From his beginnings as a child prodigy, to his work with Miles Davis, his innovations as a leader of his own groundbreaking sextet, to his collaborations with everyone, from Joni Mitchell and Stevie Wonder, the autobiography reveals the method behind Hancock's undeniable musical genius. Hancock discusses his musical influences, his long and happy marriage, and how Buddhism inspires him creatively and personally. Readers have found the book, performed by the author, to be honest, enlightening, and as vital as the man who wrote it.
Jazz is about being in the moment, at every moment. It's about trusting yourself to respond on the fly. If you can allow yourself to do that, you never stop exploring. You never stop learning in music or in life. I was lucky enough to learn this not only from playing with Miles, but over the decades of playing that have followed. And I'm still learning it every single day. It's a gift that I never could have imagined back when I first started plunking around on my friend Lavesta Carter's piano at the age of 6. Lavesta Carter lived in the same building as my family on the corner of 45th Street and King Drive on the south side of Chicago. We lived in a poor neighborhood, but it wasn't the worst one in 1940s Chicago. It was probably a step up from the worst, meaning that we didn't live in the projects, but they were close by. I never thought of our neighborhood as being a bad one, though parts of it were rough. There were gangs, and there was a rundown house down the block we called the Big House, slang for prison. Most days, there were young men hanging out in the front of the Big House, and when you saw that, you knew to walk on the other side of the street. But for the most part, I never felt unsafe or threatened. I just assumed that my neighborhood was pretty much like everyone else's. I was born in 1940, and when I was really little, I thought we were rich because we always had everything we wanted. We had clothes to wear and food to eat and a Christmas tree and toys every year. So what did I know? I had never met anyone from outside our neighborhood. And compared to some of the other families on our block, we seemed to be doing great. In the basement of our own building, there was one family living with about 10 people crammed into a single room. In comparison, we had a 2-bedroom for 5 people, my parents, my brother, Wayman, my sister, Jean, and me, which felt like a luxury. Lavesta lived on another floor in the building, and when he turned 6, his parents bought him a piano. I'd always liked just hanging around with Lavesta, but once he got that piano, all I wanted to do was go to his apartment and play it. I loved the feel of the keys under my fingers, even though I didn't really know what I was doing. We'd plunk around on it, and I'd try to play songs, and when I went back to our apartment, I'd tell my mom about it. After a while, she said to my father, "We need to get this boy a piano." And so, when I was 7, They gave me a used piano they'd bought for about $5 in a church basement. It's not surprising that my mother, Winnie Griffin Hancock, was eager for me to have a piano. She was always anxious to instill an appreciation of culture in her children, even naming me Herbert Jeffrey Hancock after an African-American singer and actor, Herb Jeffries. To my mother, culture meant music, so she made sure we grew up listening to Tchaikovsky, Beethoven, Mozart, and Handel. She also loved the music that came out of the black community, jazz and blues, and felt we should be connected to it as part of our heritage. But good music, to her, was classical music. So when I got my piano, she sent my brother and me to take classical lessons. My mother's feelings on class and culture were rooted in her unusual childhood in the South. Her mother, my grandmother Winnie Daniels, grew up poor in America's Georgia, in a family of sharecroppers working on the property of a wealthy family called the Griffins. But when my grandmother came of age, she married one of the Griffin sons, and just like that, she went from being a sharecropper to being a landowner's wife. So my mom and her brother Peter were born into a wealthier environment than most Southern black kids at the time.
We've just heard Herbie Hancock, Possibilities. In the realm of guitar gods, Carlos Santana stands alone for what's been called his universal tone. From growing up dirt poor in Mexico, to becoming a lowly dishwasher in the U.S., and then to musical superstardom, the universal tone, bringing my story to light, is the tale of a fascinating man who fills the pages with storytelling gold. Jonathan Davis performs the book.
All of a sudden, she heard this commotion out in the streets. This was her hometown, Cihuatlán, in the Jalisco province in Mexico on the Pacific coast. It was around 1938 when Mom was still living with her family. Her name was Josefina Barragan. My grandfather, her dad, Don Refugio, was complaining, "Oh, it's that Diablo Farol." They called my dad El Farol. It literally means lantern, and it was a nickname they gave him because a song he used to sing and play. "What are you talking about?" she said. "It's him, Jose Santana." My mom had run into him once when she was a little kid, and he was a teenager. Her ball landed between my dad's feet, and she ran over to get it. "Boo," he said. "Hey, little blonde girl, your hair's straight, like corn silk." And she ran away. More than 10 years later, my mom parted the window curtains and saw a group of people walking down the middle of the street with Jose in the lead and all of the town's prostitutes following him. Everyone was laughing, making music and singing. The man who would become my father was holding up his violin bow like a flagpole, and a pair of panties and brassiere were hanging from it. The mayor was next to my dad, and there were other musicians too. The town priest, who was really pissed off, was following them and trying to throw holy water on everyone. They're all making this incredible barulla, this racket. The way my mom told it, I got the feeling that these guys had been carrying on all night into the day and were just so full of themselves, drunk and wasted, that they decided to take the party into town. It was such a small town anyway. Everybody was looking at the spectacle and shaking their heads. The mayor just adored my dad. He loved musicians and their lifestyle, so who's going to tell them they can't sing and play in the streets? Most people liked my dad. He was charismatic. He was born in Cuautla, a small town around 3 hours inland, and like his father, he had become a musician. He had moved to Cihuatlán for the work, playing in symphonies and in bands that play popular Mexican songs. Don Jose, they called him. In 1983, after my son Salvador was born, I visited that part of Mexico with my dad. I met a lady there who told me, "Carlos, I grew up with Don Jose. We were from the same generation. I want you to know that you might be recognized around the world, but here, Don Jose is the Santana that counts." My dad just looked at me. I smiled and said, "Hey, that's fine with me." Not everybody felt that way in Cihuatlán, not the priest and definitely not my mom's dad. He didn't like Jose because he was a musician, and especially because he was a real Mexican, a Mexican mestizo, You could see the Indian blood in him. He was dark in complexion and proud of it. But his name Santana, or Santa Ana, came from Europe. St. Anne was Mary's mother, Joseph's mother-in-law, Jesus' grandma. Can't get much more Catholic than that. My mom's family was lighter skin, European. I once saw my family tree, and there was some Hebrew on that side of the family. There were many Jews who came over from Spain to the New World after 1492. We Santanas ate pork, but my mom had some strange rules about food. What we could and couldn't eat and when. Foods that couldn't be eaten at the same time. Some of that could have been handed down kosher stuff. The Barragans live on an hacienda. They own horses and stables and have people working for them. All my dad had was his violin. That didn't stop my mom. She used to tell me, when I saw your father at the front of that crazy parade, I knew that would be the man I would marry and leave this little town with. I had to leave. I didn't like the smell of the ranch. I didn't like men who smelled like horses and leather. But your father didn't smell like that. Jose and Josefina met up and fell in love. She did not get any blessings from her father. They eloped on a horse. Dad just stole her away. Her family came looking for them, and a friend helped them hide in Cihuatlán. Then they ran off to Atlán, where they started a family. Mom was 18, and Dad was 26. I was born a few years later, the middle child of seven. I never found exactly what the parade was about, what unholy event they were celebrating. My father never spoke about his younger days. He never spoke much about anything, really. It doesn't matter. I love all parts of their story, the sex and the religion and the humor. It shows Dad's supreme sense of charisma and Mom's supreme conviction. It shows them coming together, and it shows what they gave to me.
That was a sampling of The Universal Tone by Carlos Santana with Ashley Kahn. In 1967, when rock and roll was taking over popular music, John Byrne Cook was at the center of it all. Now, in On the Road with Janis Joplin, fans get an insider's look into Janis's life, her musical genius, and the turbulent times. As a member of D.A. Pennebaker's film crew, Cook witnessed the astonishing breakout performances of Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix at the Monterey Pop Festival. Less than 6 months later, he was on a plane to San Francisco, taking a job as a road manager for Janis and her band, Big Brother and the Holding Company. Cook was with Janis when she made the difficult decision to leave Big Brother and form a new band. He was with her when the Cosmic Blues Band toured Europe in the spring of 1969, when they performed at Woodstock in August, and when Janis and Full Tilt Boogie took their famous Festival Express train trip across Canada. He even accompanied Janis to her 10th high school reunion in Port Arthur, Texas. This intimate memoir is performed by the author.
In SFO, he attracts surreptitious glances from the servicemen emplaning for Vietnam and the businessmen in their suits. It would surprise them to know that Peter is a junior executive dressed for rock and roll. He is the member of Big Brother who signs the contracts. The one who comes to pick up the guy dispatched from New York by Albert Grossman, creator of Peter, Paul, and Mary, manager of Bob Dylan, and a host of lesser folk luminaries, to oversee the band on the road. As the music of the counterculture has evolved from folk to folk rock, the Mamas and the Papas, Simon and Garfunkel, Buffalo Springfield, to full-bore rock and roll, Albert has kept pace. When Peter's car crests the rise where Highway 101 leaves South San Francisco behind and comes in view of the city proper, I see the White Houses dancing up and down the hills and I feel at home. San Francisco is my favorite American city. I have been here often over the years, most recently in June, when I landed at SFO as part of D.A. Pennebaker's film crew on my way to Monterey for the Pop Festival. Fired then as now with the sense of moving toward the promise of things to come, ready to do my part to make the promise come true. I have a family connection to the Bay Area, an uncle who is a professor of botany at UC Berkeley. When I drove across the country for the first time in the summer after my sophomore year at Harvard, my uncle's Berkeley home was my destination. In recent years, it is music that has brought me often to the cities by the bay. From the first time I stepped into the Club 47 coffee house in Cambridge and heard Joan Baez sing, music has defined my friendships and my life. I discovered bluegrass music and became a member of Cambridge's homegrown bluegrass and old-time band, the Charles River Valley Boys. In the spring of 1963, I drove across the country again, this time with two friends from Cambridge, and we discovered in Berkeley a folk community that was welcoming and familiar. In the folk music revival, Berkeley and Cambridge were united by enthusiasm for the traditional roots of American music, black and white, and the innovations that creative players could derive from those themes. Some of my Cambridge friends made the journey to California regularly. A few moved here. The kinship forged on the Cambridge-Berkeley axis was based on sharing the music and shunning competition. We believed ourselves to be quietly superior to what we saw as the more commercially oriented pickers in New York and L.A. Our image of the prototypical New York guitar player was a guy who turned toward the wall when he played his hottest licks, so you couldn't see how he did it. Since that first visit to the Berkeley folk scene in 1963, I have come back whenever I can to play music and smoke dope and drink Jack Daniel's Tennessee whiskey and Rainier Ale, Berkeley's preferred boilermaker, known locally as J.D. and Green Death, and to experience the brilliant, preternaturally focused California days that inspire us to throw some bread and cheese and wine into a backpack and take acid and spend the day somewhere on the coast. A couple of years ago, I moved to California for what I thought would be forever, but it turned out I was chasing the wrong girl. This time, I'm here to stay. I have left behind the life of a performing musician in the interest of getting serious about the rest of my life. For now, I will help others devote themselves more fully to their music while I handle the money and logistics. I have exchanged my guitar for an attaché case. It contains itineraries, contracts, and the promise of loud music, late nights, and loose women. To Peter Albin, I reveal none of the giddy high that the waters of the bay, the sight of Coit Tower, a glimpse of the Golden Gate Bridge arouse in me. With Peter, I'm all business. I'm cool. He takes me to a motel on Columbus Avenue in North Beach. A few years ago, the North Beach coffee houses were the focus of San Francisco's folk scene, and before that, the home of the Beats. I wonder if any unamplified music survives in the city that has become the wellspring of American rock and roll. But satisfying this curiosity will have to wait. Right now, I've got to pass inspection by my prospective employers.
That was On the Road with Janis Joplin by John Byrne Cook. Readers, these musicians rocked our world, and their stories are absolutely riveting. For more intriguing biographies across the genres, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for spending this time with me. I hope you'll join me again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.